absolutely crap and you know it. You didn't look at the findings.
I did read the findings.
It's not crap. There were investigations and so-called audits in Arizona, and all of them found no evidence of widespread fraud. And Fincham's still refusing to accept the results. There's not a whole lot of precedent here for what happens if a Secretary of State just refuses to certify an election. He popped up a month later at the first Trump rally this year, saying exactly what the former president wants to hear.
Ladies and gentlemen, we know it, and they know it. Donald Trump won.
Fincham was joined by members of the upper echelon of right-wing conspiracy theorists, like Stop the Steal leader Ali Alexander, the alleged Q behind QAnon, Ron Watkins, and MyPillow CEO, Mike Lindell.
And I will promise you this, there's not going to be any election done with any machines or computers done in 2022.
These guys have plans. No machines, says Lindell. Fincham wants to get rid of mail-in voting entirely. But Arizona Republicans mail in their ballots too, at about the same rate as Democrats. If he's Secretary of State, it could be harder for everyone to vote. But don't ask him about it.
Sir, if you get rid of mail-in voting, will there be a lot of people in Arizona that you think may not vote?
No, there's a lot of people in Arizona that are demanding that we do away with mail-in voting. You probably ought to check the polls.
There were more than a million people that voted by mail, though.
Okay, you're not listening to me.
I'm listening to you.
La, la, la.
So that we'll go out with that with Mark Fincham, the Republican nominee for Secretary of State of Arizona, saying la, la, la. Thank you so much. This has been Jacqueline Keeler with American Standoff.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 11 a.m.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO's Board of Directors is delighted to invite all KBOO members to the annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections. The meeting will be held on Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. A Zoom link and call-in access will be provided to those who are unable to attend in person. This is the opportunity for all members to meet the candidates, get station updates, and make their voices heard. Again, that's KBOO's annual membership meeting and Board of Directors elections, Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2022.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. Joyce Carol Oates is one of America's greatest writers and one of its most prolific. Over a career that spans nearly six decades, according to Wikipedia, she's written 58 novels, and according to Goodreads, she has had 116 books published. She's been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction five times and has been nominated and won many other literary awards. Among her best-known works, and perhaps her magnum opus, is Blonde, one of the Pulitzer finalists and a nominee for the National Book Award. This epic novel from 2000 is a retelling of the life of Marilyn Monroe, On May 3rd, 2000, my late co-host Richard A. Lupoff and I interviewed Joyce Carol Oates about Blonde and about her career. This wide-ranging conversation was one of the last analog recordings we made and has not been heard in 20 years. Blonde, it's a mixture of fact and fiction, as are many books, but it seems to move into a different direction. It is not quite a docudrama because it's more novel than that, and yet many of the characters are quite real, and some of them are quite alive at this point. So I'd like to start by asking you about stretching the boundaries between fiction and nonfiction, and more specifically, how far can you go, do you think, with using a particular biography as a fictional iconography?
Well, I think it's a very good question. It's very provocative. And for those of us who are interested in the theory of literature, it is very stimulating. Basically, I wanted to write a novel about the life, the private life, of someone we think we know as Marilyn Monroe. And obviously, I'm looking at a mythic American cultural icon and wanting to get beyond that or beneath that, and also dealing with the person who becomes this icon. So I was really focusing upon the phenomenon of a private and almost ordinary or average human being in America to whom celebrity comes fairly soon in her life. And that would seem to me that if this happened to us, there would be an element of the surreal and even the hallucinatory, that things would happen to us that had a quality of almost of Alice in Wonderland. So the novel is basically somewhat experimental. And when real people enter into the orbit of Norma Jean Baker or Marilyn Monroe, many of them have the cast of a somewhat mythic definition. For instance, Joe DiMaggio doesn't appear in the novel as himself, but he's the ex-athlete. Arthur Miller doesn't appear in the novel as himself. He's the playwright. And John F. Kennedy is mythologized as the president. So it both is and isn't a realistic novel.
There's a film that came out several years ago called The Goddess, which is, are you familiar with the film?
I've heard the title, and I mean to see it, but I didn't see it yet.
Okay, because it deals with many of the same themes.
But it's not really Marilyn Monroe, sort of a generic.
It's a generic individual.
Yes.
And what's Kim Stanley plays the character, and
yes.
What's astonishing is that creating a sex goddess out of an individual who physically is not attractive is kind of a jump, because she wasn't that attractive at the time. So it's kind of an interesting.
But the movie worked.
The movie works very much
uh-huh.
so.
The question that is, I think, unavoidable is whether Norma Jean Baker or Marilyn Monroe was totally a victim, or was she in some sense responsible for herself? Or yet a third possibility, did she really exist at all?
Norma Jean Baker obviously existed, and we have our various projections and interpretations of her. If you look at the actual history as evidence in the biographies, you can see that she was a very yearning and hopeful girl, deeply insecure. She may have been very ambitious simply as a way of surviving, the way desperate people sometimes seem to be driven because they feel that they don't have any other alternative or their backs are against the wall. In boxing sometimes, and I've written a book on boxing and I know a few boxers, but in boxing sometimes a young athlete will feel that every time he climbs into the ring he's fighting for his life. And it sounds like an extreme statement, but I think that what they mean is they're fighting desperately not to be knocked out yet, because if they're knocked out, their career may end. So Norma Jean was rather like that. She came from a very loveless background. She had no money. She had no protection in terms of a family. She had virtually no self-definition. So she was complicit in any fate that was offered to her. She was an accomplice. I wouldn't think of her as being a victim. She was offered, for instance, a position as a model. Well, another girl might say, well, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be modeling in bathing suits, you know. And another girl might have said, I will not bleach my hair. They told her to bleach her hair. Now, Marilyn Monroe in real life did these things. She was not yet Marilyn Monroe. She was actually Norma Jean. They said, bleach your hair. And she did. Now, some of us may not have done that, but then we would not have been Marilyn Monroe. No one would have heard of us. Overnight, after she bleached her hair this very synthetic color, overnight she became the most sought-after model in her modeling agency. So that worked. It was sort of it's trickery, and it's very synthetic. It's a marketing device, become a blonde, and it did work. She wasn't a victim.
Well, there's a desperation involved, though, and you're raising the simile of boxing. As strange as it may sound, I can see the comparison because I've read some of your work on boxing. The desperation and the ferocity that this situation imposes upon us. I kept thinking of your essay on Mike Tyson and the desperation and ferocity that drove him to literal cannibalism in the ring.
Well, literal cannibalism when he bit Evander Holyfield's ear.
Yes.
Yeah, he bit it twice. Actually, at that point, I don't think he was desperate anymore. The young Mike Tyson was someone who was fighting for his life, but the Tyson we have now, who is really over the hill, he's over his 30s, he's over 30. He's not really a young, hungry fighter any longer. But when he was young, he was, of course, from a ghetto, and he didn't have a family. He was out on the street when he was 10 years old. So, too, Norma Jean Baker had a mother who, for one reason or another, primarily because she was mentally unstable, the mother didn't love her. And the analog, I think, holds that there are some people in our society who are so desperate and so driven to be accepted, to be loved, to be respected, that they will do so much more than the average person will.
Hunger and this drive, this fierce drive, is something that happens in a lot of your books. And I'm just wondering, in a more general sense, whether we're talking about the American dream. We see it in books as disparate as Because It's Bitter and Because It Is My Heart, down through even Blackwater, where the heroine is thinking about her future and her own desperation there. But it's something that's a constant theme through your books. And I'd like you to address it both in terms of the American dream and in terms of the writing of Joyce Carol Oates.
Well, I suppose it is predominant. It's not that I'm always thinking about these things, actually. It may be part of our American story. America was settled partly by people who might have been seen as desperate. I don't mean the original settlers, and I don't mean the Puritans, though there may have been an air of messianic zeal in those people. But you could say that America was settled by people who were in some ways misfits. You know, they weren't fitting into European culture. They weren't that well-to-do in England, so they come to this country. And then it's almost like a free-for-all where here's this country. It's uncultivated. It's unsettled. And people are literally running out to the West and seeking their fortunes, trying to mine gold. So there's something special about the United States as a phenomenon in history, that it does seem to embody these characteristics we associate with Darwinian evolutionary theory. Let's think of this survival of the fittest and natural selection, rather more than a society more settled like England, where there's a very definite class structure.
You have the desperate characters coming out of desperate situations, but then you've got, particularly in Blonde, the reverse. The wealthy character who doesn't know what to do with themselves. And in particular, I'm thinking of the characters you call the Gemini, Charlie Chaplin Jr. and Edward G. Robinson Jr.
Well, they weren't really wealthy. They were the sons of quite well-known fathers, but the fathers weren't very generous with them. Charlie Chaplin Sr. was not a good father to Charlie Chaplin Jr. So the connection between Norma Jean and these two young men was basically that they all had problem fathers. Norma Jean didn't know who her father was. They could never forget who their fathers were.
Does this father problem, does it pervade your works? I might suggest that it does, but that wouldn't be fair. I'm thinking in of your essays about people like Ed Gein, Jeffrey Dahmer, and Ted Bundy, and at the same time, a novel like Foxfire, where there are all these problem fathers.
Well, in Foxfire, there's a certain myth, I think, that girls can have their own world, their own autonomy. I thought of Foxfire as rather more of a, almost like a ballad or a folktale, that the girls can create a society that's autonomous, and it's sort of vis-a-vis and antagonistic to men. And many of the fathers don't exist, and they're just not there. You know, they're gone from the families. So the girls have to embody masculine traits in themselves.
In Blonde, you've said that the entire book, in a sense, is coming out of this Norma Jean who exists out of time.
Yes, I thought of it having a voiceover, almost like a long movie.
And I wonder about how that voice perceives the difference between reality and myth.
That's a very probing question. It may have been that I imagined a perspective that was timeless, as if having passed out of her mortal body, her spirit is somehow able to brood upon past and near present, and so she can look upon her earliest life and with her memories with her mother and the search for the father. It's almost as if we might have a spirit independent of the body. And I'm not meaning to be mystical or especially religious about this, but it is quite possible, you know, that somehow we transcend the body and we can look into the deep past. So basically there's no time element in Blonde because it's all one time. But then, of course, most of the novel does respect chronological order.
Well, the reason I'm driving at that is because since you deal with the iconography and the myth of the ex-ball player, the playwright, the Gemini, her main companions in the course of the book, as well as just focusing on individual movies, wouldn't a spirit in that sense only deal with those major themes rather than the lesser ones if you're looking back on a life like that?
Well, I think we look back upon our lives sometimes when we're just in a state of meditation and we see how we were so compelled to take very seriously things that in retrospect were very insignificant. You know, it's like we don't really know what's important at the time. We can be overcome by a trivial thing.
You're listening to an interview with Joyce Carol Oates, recorded on May 3rd, 2000, while she was on tour for her novel Blonde. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Rich Walensky on Bookwaves. When I was reading a biography about you titled Invisible Writer,
yes,
there was mention of how you, Joyce Smith, perceives Joyce Carol Oates as this other entity, and perhaps even Rosamund Smith as this other entity. And I was thinking about that in relation to Blonde, where Marilyn Monroe is a minor entity in the life of Norma Jean.
Well, that's true. She's a minor entity at first, and then she becomes something that's almost suffocating and overwhelming.
But she never is Marilyn Monroe. It's this act.
Yeah, I think that's true. It's the way she's perceived. Well, it's a question, I think, of how one defines oneself. Obviously, when we're very young, we have our names that our parents have given us. And probably we retain that identity throughout our lives.
What I'm driving at here is, who am I talking to? Am I talking to Joyce Carol Oates, the icon? Am I talking to Joyce Smith, the person?
Well, let's see. There's no icon. Icons don't exist. An icon is a statue or a poster or a face on a cigarette box, you know. Basically, that's a brand name, so you can't talk to an icon, and the person who stands in for the icon may be kind of embarrassed or amused or whatever. If Norma Jean Baker could see her own image all over, you know, the image of her at the age of 26 when she was in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, this is the one that's all over, she would now be about 71 or 73 years old, and she would look upon this and probably just laugh and say, well, did I ever look like that? Probably not, because I was airbrushed and they fixed my hair and they took 1,600 photographs to get that one. No, you're basically talking to Joyce. You could just call me Joyce, and I'm a person who's been around for quite a while. I do have the same personality basically that I had when I was 12 or 11 or probably 5. Certainly the same personality I had when I was 16, 21. So I think we have a persistent quality of personality that goes through our entire lives. And sometimes even in families, there are mannerisms and habits of speech and just the way you hold your head. You'll see it in the whole family. And one person has it throughout his or her entire life. So Norma Jean, when she was 5, 6, 10, 11 years old, is basically the same person who will have to deal with the overwhelming phenomenon of being, quote, Marilyn Monroe when she's in her 20s.
But when you're talking to me and you're that same 12-year-old person, how would you perceive the writer Joyce Carol Oates? Would you see that as the name on a book or as, say, Marilyn would see it, or Norma Jean would see Marilyn Monroe as the name on a film?
Well, again, it really is a very profound question, because a writer or an artist tends to be a person who is intensely involved in a project, one after another, the way an actor is intensely involved in his or her performance. But though we do remember the work, I think, quite well, I remember all my books, we are not so intensely involved in it. It would be as if you were asked to remember in detail something, a paper you wrote when you were in college that you really worked hard on, and at one time in your life was very important, but now you sort of remember it, but you can't even remember whether it was 12 pages long or 18 or 20, you know. It's not that you've forgotten it, but it's not that intense. So when I look upon my own work, I look upon, because it is bitter and because it is my heart, which you have over there, I think of Iris, who was the main character, and she seems almost like a bitten off part of my own heart, and I remember her very well, and I remember Jinx, I remember him playing basketball, but I remember these people in a way that I might remember real people, that is like snapshot memory. I'm not remembering so much the whole phenomenon of a written work. It's more like I'm remembering actual people.
When we have an artist in her body of work, and that artist steps back and looks at it, does she see herself as, I am an artist, that's who I am, that's what I am, or does she simply say, hey, look, I'm a whole human being, I do things like brush my teeth and go to the baseball game, and that's something that I do, but not what I am?
Well, again, I don't know how to answer that. It depends on how one defines the personality. Are we a complete entity in terms of all these manifold definitions? You could also say we are as many people know us. You know, William James says that our identities are multiple in terms of how many people know us. You know, that you're a father to somebody, but you are a son to somebody else, and probably those two people are very different. If you are a father to some children, you're a different person than you are as the son to your own father. And yet, you're the same person. You know, it's kind of a mystery that way.
There's another issue that I'd like to discuss with you, and that is the distinction, if there is one, between literary fiction and genre fiction. You have addressed both in your essays, and of course, as a writer, I guess you would say that you have written both.
Well, I love genre work. To me, genre is to be distinguished from traditional fiction in one basic way. The genre work will always explain itself or come to a resolution in the last chapter. And that's why we read genre. That's why we read, say, Sherlock Holmes, because there's a mystery. It begins with a mystery, and if the writer is really good, we're mystified. But then we don't remain mystified. By the end of the novel or the story, it's cleared up. The same thing is not necessarily true with traditional fiction. You can read a whole novel by Thomas Pynchon, let's say, or Thomas Mann, and you might still be a bit mystified at the end because there aren't any clear answers. There are some people who love genre because it has a formulaic symmetry, and there's a satisfaction in that. I do like that, but I don't always write that way.
Is Rosamund Smith a literary writer or a genre writer?
I'm afraid Rosamund Smith is getting to be more of a literary writer. I had wanted to have a pseudonym that could be a repository for the kind of writing that basically I don't do. It was supposed to be cinematic and swift-moving and working, if not to formula, at least working to form. And it would have qualities that Oates doesn't have. Swiftness and relative superficiality is not the best word. I don't really mean that, but a narrative that moves swiftly along like a speedboat across the water rather than going more slowly like a heavier vehicle, which is more like what Oates does. Blonde, for instance, is obviously a novel. It's a very traditional novel. It's a postmodernist and experimental novel. It's psychologically realistic, and it's not really in any way a genre work because we don't know clearly how the mystery turns out. But I've written other works in which there are murders, there are deaths that seem mysterious, and then people in the novel seek to find out the truth, and by the end of the novel, they and the reader have found out the truth. And so that was supposed to be the Rosamund Smith novels. But they've gotten longer, I'm afraid, and they've gotten more poetic. So I was thinking of actually choosing a new pseudonym and going back to a more spare style.
When you're involved in a book, whether it be Rosamund Smith, whether it be a collection of short stories, but more when you're writing these novels, the word often used to describe you, and maybe it's your own word, is obsessive. You get caught up in it to such a great degree. How do you deal with that obsessiveness in terms of the rest of your life?
I think writing Blonde was the most extreme experience in my life, and I don't intend to repeat it. It was obsessive, partly because I identified with Norma Jean and in many ways, some of them somewhat personal. Also, Norma Jean was very much like girls with whom I went to junior high school, girls I remember from the past, who were from broken homes, who were rather like the young Marilyn Monroe. They were so eager to be pretty and to be pleasant. They wanted to get married. They wanted to have babies, as Norma Jean did. In a way, it was almost an accident that Marilyn Monroe emerges out of Norma Jean, because what Norma Jean really wanted was to be a housewife and mother.
I keep thinking of that obsessiveness that you have. You make a comment in a written piece that this book was an attempt not to look at her, but to actually be her.
That's the way it became. And so if you read the novel, you actually become Norma Jean, and then this bizarre celebrity starts to happen to you. At first, it's like a glimmering in the future at the horizon, and you think, oh, well, it's not going to be real. Norma Jean says, well, I don't really look like that. She's shown these beautiful still photographs of herself, and she says, well, but I don't really look like that. And the photographer says, no, you don't look like that, but it doesn't matter because the photograph looks like that, and that's all that matters.
Well, when you come toward the end of the book and the celebrity is full flower, then who has control of Marilyn Monroe? And this is not just simply Marilyn Monroe, but what we've seen in the past decade is celebrity, and the cult of celebrity has gotten so out of hand that you wonder who has control of not merely Marilyn Monroe, but Tom Cruise, Meryl Streep, Michael Jackson, and so on, Michael Jordan, and so on and so forth.
Well, it seems to be something that's becoming a national obsession because we don't have any sacred icons, so we have to create these secular icons, and they're in our society, they're tied in with selling running shoes and selling tickets to movies and so forth. Yes, I think it's a very interesting question. Who has control? Well, the media has control, but the media is manifold. I mean, what is the media? There are many different forms of the media. It's like a great octopus. And if you were somebody who touched upon celebrity in some way, you would probably find that you couldn't stop it. You know, it's like a faucet you turn on. You say, well, I'd like to be famous, I guess, because maybe then I'd make some money. And people from my old high school would call me up, and my parents would be so fond of me, and everybody would be proud of me. So you say, well, I'll be famous for a while, and you turn the faucet on. But then you can't turn the faucet off. So suddenly you want to go just down the street to have dinner in your neighborhood restaurant, and you want to be with your friends. But suddenly you can't because there's a small army of autograph seekers out in the street, and there's a film crew, and there's television, and they're taking your photograph, and you say, hey, I don't want this anymore. Now I want to go back to being my own self. You can't do it. So I think that's the nightmare that Marilyn Monroe stumbled into, that she was a very, very vivacious, beautiful girl in her 20s, and it was fine that photographers were taking her picture all the time, and she was even exhibiting her beautiful body. Then the years go by, and she's over 30. She's 35. She's 36. She knows now that the camera is going to catch her in such a way that will reveal her age. She'll be like Elizabeth Taylor was shortly to be exposed in all the tabloids. We've seen these ugly photographs of Elizabeth Taylor. She's gotten a little heavy. And there the photographs are, and you can't hide. So suddenly the media that had seemed to be your friend and was promulgating your image and you're making money, now the media is out to get you. And I think that's a terrifying experience.
You've been listening to an interview with Joyce Carol Oates, recorded May 3rd, 2000, while she was on tour for her epic novel, Blonde. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff.